Hello and welcome to another episode of TTT, Talking Transport Transformation. I'm your host Hannah, and today we have an insightful discussion lined up for you. In this episode, we'll be exploring the intriguing world of popular transport. Or as I like to say, the artist formerly known as informal transport or paratransit. Our expert guest, Andrea Sanguileon, discusses why this part of the transport sector should be called what it is, a popular, a widely used transportation solution. We will delve into what sets the sector apart from traditional or formalized transport systems, and we will explore the reasons behind its existence in various geographies. Additionally, we will have to look at how this sector can move towards integration and decarbonization within the larger transport framework. Our guest today is Andrea Sanguileon, a leading expert in sustainable transport and urban sustainability. Andrea is the executive director of the Global Network for Popular Transportation, founder of the Center for Urban Sustainability in Costa Rica, and co-founder of Agile City Partners. With over a decade of experience, she brings a wealth of knowledge and passion to this discussion between her and my colleague Keisha, who is asking the questions in this episode. So stay tuned as we dive into the complexities and the future of popular transport.
Hello, we're here today with our guest, Andrea Sanguileon, who is going to talk about popular transportation. So first, Andrea, tell us about yourself and your work with the Global Network for Popular Transportation.
So hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. My name is Andrea Sanguileon, as Keisha mentioned. I am Costa Rican, and I am the executive director of the Global Network for Popular Transportation. We are a nonprofit. We're an initiative that tries to position and bring the conversation about popular transport, which we will explain in a bit what it's all about, but trying to get it to be recognized as a type of transport that is essential, that it's an essential service to be able to generate inclusion and accessibility to transport services and to hopefully integrate it into planning, into investment, policy, et cetera, in cities around the world.
Great. And I'm happy to have you here to talk about that. So first of all, paratransit, informal transportation, and now popular transport. Why does it matter how we call these transport modes and how have they impacted the way we see mobility?
Usually this type of transport, which is essentially the type of transport that comes from people to the people, that's why we call it popular transport. This type of transport is transport services that are public transport, but that are not provided or operated or many times even recognized by the government or local authorities. So this type of transport is private service that pops up whenever someone actually needs to move around and doesn't have a private vehicle and cannot access public transport, or the public transport options are very limited. And then someone says, hey, I actually have a car, or I have a minivan, or I have a motorcycle, and they start providing the service. So there are different names that are used around the world. Locally, they all have a different name. Sometimes in Latin America, they're called pirates, piratas, colectivos. In India, we have tuk-tuks, rickshaws. In Africa, we have bora-bora. So every region has its own name for these services. But in academia and international conversations, there's been a big debate on how this is called. And so there are several names. So for example, paratransit or informal transportation or artisanal transport. We don't like those that much. And we proposed using popular transport because we like calling things for what they are rather than what they are not. So we understand that these services are often in the margins of regulations, so they are not using formal contracts. So the word informal describes them for what they are not rather than what they are. Or the word paratransit suggests that they are services that are inferior or that should be something else. So I think the language that we use to name something is very important when we have these conversations, and we would rather use language that describes the service for what it is, something popular, something that comes from people, something that serves millions of people, than saying what it should be or what it's not. So essentially, there are a lot of ways to call this, but we choose to use the word popular transport.
Thank you. That was so informative, because then when people get confused with what they're called, at least now they know. I think we should popularize the term popular transport. And you mentioned a little bit earlier about how people came to offer these popular transport modes, but how did they come about from your research, and where did they come from? How come not all cities have them as much?
It's very context specific. You will see that popular transport is mostly everywhere, at least in the global south, and it responds to need. So essentially, it's a solution that people develop because they need to move. And that's how it appears. Someone needs to move, and there are not enough options provided by the authorities to move around in public transport. So they find a way. People will always find a way. And so in some places, maybe it's in the mountainside and the roads are not very smooth, so it will might be a pickup truck, for example. In island towns, maybe there will be small boats that will move people around, and it will become someone's business. It's a small and medium enterprise to be a driver of a boat or of a motorcycle or of a truck to move people around. And that's how it happens. Someone will find a business niche there to cover people's needs to mobilize. And that's how it starts. And a lot of cities now have a public transport network that's very robust and it's very professional. And it started out like this. The difference is that when the sector becomes more professional and more organized and bigger scale, it actually usually happens because there's a support and a coordination with the local authorities. So the authorities will say, hey, we want to scale this up. We can provide support, or we can hire you to provide the service that you're already providing. And that's when it shifts to government recognized or funded or operated system, right? So it's essentially the same thing, but in many places, the local authorities don't have the capacity or the interest to engage with these operators and to say, hey, you're providing a service that I should be providing. Because essentially, that's how it works. It's a public service that the public authorities should be providing, but they just can't in many cases because we don't have enough resources. We don't have enough capacity in many places in the global south. So it becomes a private service. So the places where this doesn't often exist is because there is a local government or a national government has invested and has developed a model to be able to at least fund or contract or do tender or just have an operation of public transport under their regulations and under their rules. But when this doesn't happen and the local government, national government is not able to, then someone else will do it. And that's kind of the difference of why can't I find this maybe in some places in Europe or in some places in the United States or even some places, big cities in the global south, because there's a big public transport network that works, right? But maybe if you go to the outskirts, to the smaller towns or places where there's not a very robust network or system, you will find these services.
Sounds very complex, and it sounds like there are a lot of existing kinds of popular transport systems out there. I understand you also made a collection of what they're called all around the world. I'm curious, since you mentioned it earlier, we have some in Africa, we have some in Latin America. What similarities and differences can you see existing beyond these different geographies? What have you observed?
I think the key similarity is that the people who provide these services are entrepreneurs, and we often don't see it as such. And the framing and the narrative around this is that it is basically like they're criminals. We need to persecute them and eradicate this service. It's problematic to the city. But how we see them is these are SMEs. They're essentially small businesses that start to operate, that provide a livelihood for a lot of people who many times don't have any other options. And so this is one of the key similarities that we see in different places, that It's people who start a business and then they start growing sometimes. Sometimes they just stay one person providing the service. Another characteristic that we've seen is that this type of transport is usually associated with chaos. People think it's chaotic, that it's not organized, but it's the complete opposite. They're usually very much organized. They have either cooperatives or associations, or at least they have WhatsApp groups and talk to each other. And they always find a way to organize, because at the end of the day, that way they can provide a better service. And they're trying to be able to set up, for example, areas where different groups can provide different services, etc. And then another characteristic is that it's very much intertwined with community and with access to opportunities. And so there's, for example, in Mexico, it's called neighborhood mobility, movilidad de barrio. And I really like that name because it's mostly the story of how this originates in a lot of places. Someone will say, hey, I'll put my minibus so we can all go to the city because the bus doesn't get here, right? So it has this characteristic of starting out in a smaller scale and a more like community service characteristic. Then, of course, if it's a bigger city, maybe it widens and it's not like that. Those are kind of the similarities that I see in a lot of places. And then some of the differences essentially is especially the vehicles. And the vehicles respond to different elements. So, for example, as I was saying before, if the road is narrow, if the road is very bumpy, or if it's a dirt road, maybe the vehicles will be a bit different than in places where it's very paved and very, very homogeneous. Or depending on also kind of the income level in places, there might be, or the regulation even, there's a lot of places where motorcycle taxis are huge. But then there's other places where they don't exist because it's not allowed to have a motorcycle taxi at all. And so this category doesn't exist. For example, in a lot of places in Latin America, it's not common at all to have motorcycle taxis. But they're huge in some places in Africa or some places in Asia. So it really responds to the context, to the geography, to the weather, but even also the industries that are present in each of the regions. If a region has an industry of 2- and 3-wheelers, it will be much easier to have popular transportation use these vehicles because they will be cheap, right? So there's a lot of different elements that will determine which are the vehicles that will be used in each town or city.
Quite interesting. It's also really nice to see that there are rising different types of popular transport. Now they're electrifying these types of transport. Kind of related to that, how can popular transport now help in decarbonizing a whole mobility system? What is their role?
So usually the first answer is electrifying, but I actually want to take us a step back because sometimes when we talk about decarbonizing a sector, we always think about technology. But there are two things that we need to think about when we're thinking about decarbonizing the transport sector. First of all, we need to remember that popular transport is public transport. So essentially, it's shared transport, it's shared mobility. So it is already reducing emissions because people who are using popular transport are not using a private vehicle, are not buying a car, or are not using a car. So it's shared mobility at its essence. So eradicating it often actually has negative impacts because people will be forced to buy their own vehicles and will stop using shared transport. So that's very, very important to take into consideration. The main thing that we could do to decarbonize the sector beyond electrifying is to improve it. If the service is better quality, if it's safer, if it's more comfortable, more people will keep using it and not leave it to go to buy a private vehicle. So it's essentially the same mindset that we should have for government-regulated or operated public transport systems. The same way that we're strengthening these systems in different places around the world to make them better, more efficient, safer, nicer, so people can keep using them and use them more, we should be thinking the same thing for popular transport. But that's not the case. Usually, climate action and efforts to improve public transport don't even consider popular transport. It's like, okay, we'll improve this one and the other one will cease to exist. And we've seen many cases of investment and actions to improve the government-operated public transport. And then people will keep using popular transport because it provides connectivity and it provides flexibility and it covers their needs. So essentially, I think one of the first things that we need to think is that this is part of the public transport network. Someone else operates it, but it is public transport. So any effort to improve public transport must include popular transport. And that will lead us towards a more decarbonized sector. And that comes a lot with also integration. One of the biggest nuisances for a transport user is for the system to not be integrated. It's like, okay, I'll take the motorcycle taxi to here, and then I have to take a bus that uses this payment mode from here to here, and then I have to walk or take the bike. If the system is integrated and the different actors that provide the services kind of get together and think, how can we make this as efficient as possible and that it can work as a system, then users will keep using it and use it more. And so beyond improving it, the integration part is essential. And there's several cities and countries that have been, for example, using the same public transport card for payment that is used for the government system with the popular transport operators. And they started working with them to integrate at least the payment. And that makes a lot of difference for the users, right? And then finally, electrifying. When we think about the efforts towards decarbonization, I always like to talk about the other things first, because we should focus on avoiding, shifting, and then improving. And the improvement part is more focused on tech and efficiency. And so that's why I always get to electrification last. So definitely these vehicles need to be electrified as well. 2- and 3-wheelers are leading the way around the globe. They're the vehicles that are electrifying the fastest. And this is very, very exciting. The amount of emissions that are being reduced just by the shift towards electric in 2- and 3-wheelers is very, very impressive and very exciting. We need to bring the other types of vehicles on board as well. So for example, minibus taxis, there's some research being done on how to electrify these vehicles. But going back to the idea that these are small and medium enterprises, we can't think just about the vehicle. It's like, oh yeah, but there are options in the market. You just electrify. There's so many barriers around being able to electrify these vehicles that we need to find innovative models for this to happen. So for instance, in motorcycles and even some 3-wheelers, there's new models that involve battery swapping. So people don't have to buy an electric motorcycle with the battery, which is the most expensive part. They just buy or lease, that's even easier, lease the motorcycle, operate it, and then they go to stations where they swap the batteries as if you were charging fuel. You go ship the battery, and that way it's a very, very cheap model to which people can shift very easily and without a large capital investment. We need to remember that people who operate these modes usually do it because it's cheap and you can start having your business from day one if you already have a vehicle. But to invest in a new vehicle, when your income is a daily income, you don't have a monthly salary, you don't have a lot of savings, you need to have a model where you could, for example, have microloans that can be paid daily rather than per month, a big investment at the beginning. So the financial mechanisms to be able to allow for the electrification have to adapt to the reality of the sector. And we're seeing that a lot of these operators, for example, are not funded by banks because they're seen as risky. And so they receive loans. They have very, very, very high interest rates. And so they end up paying more when they have less income originally. So this is something that we've been looking at, and that fortunately some development banks started seeing this as a development issue and now are adjusting the way that they structure their funding, and they accompany that funding with for example, some technical advisory at first to strengthen these operations, to strengthen these businesses so that they can lend money to them afterwards to change their vehicles, to improve their operations, etc. It's not the same to electrify a government bus fleet of 100 big articulated buses than to fund one guy who has one minibus taxi and that has a daily income and that can't actually take money out of this pocket to change it into an electric vehicle. So we need to adjust our expectations and also our strategies and approaches to create products and financial mechanisms that will actually serve this sector so that it's not left behind, which is right now happening. It's being left behind, especially some of these service providers, simply because they're not the public that banks or funders are usually used to working with. So that's kind of a thing that we need to keep in mind when electrifying. But it is absolutely essential that the sector participates in the transition towards decarbonization. We've run some numbers, and we could say that almost 70% of all the trips that are done in road transport around the world are done using popular transport. So the potential to decarbonize the sectors, the majority of the trips around the world are made using these services. If we were to decarbonize these vehicles and change the technology, the potential to reduce emissions is enormous. So we can't let it just not happen, right?
Wow, that's actually quite amazing. 70%. And I like your points on how you put it together with the avoid, shift, improve framework. So first is to really support popular transport modes through financing. Then second is to really integrate it in the existing system and look at it as a whole. And third, which is emerging, is to electrify these modes. But it's not the only concern. These are such great points because people don't see in depth on the issues of popular transport and how it can actually help them in the long run. Maybe a next question then. Aside from looking at the role of popular transport, what are the gender and social equity aspects of popular transport that we should be aware about? And are there relevant intersections?
I think going back to the origins of why does popular transport comes in, we need to remember that it usually appears in places where public transport is not serving the population. And that is often places where there are marginalized communities, maybe informal settlements, slums. And in many cases, a lot of the people who use these types of services will be women or students or people with care responsibilities. Why? Because in many cases, if a family actually manages to buy a vehicle, it will be the man who uses the vehicle and then the woman has to figure out how to move around, right? And this is a reality in a lot of places around the world. Then there's also a reality that in many countries, the poorest households in these places are run by women. This is also something that is frequent and that happens. And so you have a combination of different elements here where the most vulnerable populations are actually not served well by public transport. And then also you have, for example, even additional layers. If we think about intersectionality, for example, race, in a lot of countries, the poorest neighborhoods are actually also the neighborhoods where Black and brown people live that are not served well by public transport because there's been historically a segregation in the territory and the transport systems were not designed to serve these people, right? So at the end of the day, now we have popular transport systems, which were the way that they figured out they could move around, and we keep punishing them for finding a solution to their needs. And so this definitely has a layer of social and economic criteria that need to be considered, because if we eliminate these services or if we ban them, there will be a lot of people who will be impacted and who will lose their access to mobility, their access to opportunities, to education, to jobs, and they are usually the most marginalized communities. And this is something that we need to take into consideration. That's also why we always talk a lot about just transition in the sector, not only for the workers, but also for the users. If we really want people to not be left behind, we have to improve their conditions, improve their access, improve their services. And that means that this is very interconnected with different SDGs. It's not only SDG 13 in terms of climate action, it's gender, it's innovation, it's livelihoods, it's access to education, etc. Improving transport for these populations will actually generate impacts in other social and economic dimensions.
That is very relevant, and I agree. When you improve access to the most marginalized people in society through popular transport, they're able to do so much more and participate in society in a more empowered way. Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the best practices in popular transport is to integrate it in the existing public transport system. What are some examples of this that you've seen? Is there a need to quote-unquote formalize it? What are some interesting and successful alternatives you've seen with how cities have dealt with popular transport?
There's different examples, and I think one of the keywords is precisely what you mentioned. Usually the conversation centers around, we need to formalize this. But there's so many other steps that we can take before even formalizing, and that's why I like to talk about integrating. Because the end goal at the end of the day should be to integrate this into the system and to improve it. The way that we do it, it maybe formalization comes in there, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the first step. So we've seen, for example, in Mexico City, there was an initiative to start doing kind of a census to really understand first. We've seen this in several cities. In Bolivia, there was one also who did this. Because oftentimes governments want to do something about this and they have no idea what the scale of the sector is. They don't know how many operators, they don't know how many vehicles are moving around. They don't know which areas they're providing services to. They don't know, for example, how many people this sector is serving. They just see it as problematic and that it's stealing maybe users from their systems, but they don't see it as an asset. So first of all, it's really important to measure it. And so one of the key steps that a lot of cities are taking is maybe I need to understand the sector and what it's actually doing. And so beyond cities, there's also been a lot of research in trying to map it, right? So you see the map of public transport in the city, official public transport. And then you see the big map of popular transport covering all the areas where the official transport network is not covering. And that actually is very powerful to see it as an asset. It's like, oh, wow, this is actually reaching all the places that I should be providing services to, but I'm not. So with that information, you can actually start planning the system better and say, hey, what if we actually hire these guys to keep doing the work that they're doing, but in a better way and in a more official way. And so we've seen, for example, in South Africa, a few local governments that started sitting down with the minibus taxi associations to say, hey, you're already covering this area. What if I provide this support? For example, I'll develop some infrastructure for you to provide the service better. I will support you in becoming a company so that I can hire you with my public resources. And so this conversation, the first thing is to have that conversation and to have information about the operation of the system so that we can move forward to improving it, right? And so first of all, that information part is essential. And then second of all, trying to identify what are the needs of the sector. Because sometimes it's like, a lot of governments get to a third step that is saying, you need to comply with all of this or else I will ban you. But they're not listening to really understand if the sector can actually comply with this, if they have the capacity, right? Or if they need subsidies, if they need infrastructure, if they need funding, if they need support. And again, at the end of the day, it is the mandate of the local authorities to provide a service that is high quality. And so there will have to be a conversation to identify what do we need to do to take it there, right? So formalizing for me is not the end goal. The end goal is to improve the sector and to integrate it and to provide a service that is the best service possible for users. So yeah, we've seen actions from just gathering of data and start those conversations to what I was mentioning before, for example, to use electronic payment card to start integrating and generating data to better improve planning and integration just through the payment system, right? So sometimes it's smaller steps to achieve this. We've seen examples also of sitting down at the sector and saying, hey, the vehicles you have are not really safe for people to use. How can we agree on what is the model and what are the conditions that will be good that we agree upon? And this will be the official criteria, government criteria of what the vehicles must comply with. And we will support you and create a fund to recapitalize the vehicles and change them, right? But that conversation has to happen and there has to be conditions that allow for the change to happen and not force it. Because again, the sector itself is vulnerable because it assumes all the risk. There's no government investment. Usually there's no funding, nor support, no subsidies. And so if we want this to be part of a government effort, there has to be some support to take it to that other level.
Wow, that's great. I also realized that when you go to these different cities and you try to navigate as a foreigner, it's difficult because these popular transport systems are not necessarily on a map. To integrate them with a bigger public transport system would be so useful and can be used as an asset. I hope popular transport systems do get support. Talking about what you do with a Global Network for Popular Transport, or GNPT, are there any activities that we should know about that you're doing recently, and how could we find out more about popular transport?
Sure. There's different ways. So one of the key ways to keep updated on all that's happening on popular transport around the world is our newsletter. We have a newsletter called Pop Transport, where we consolidate all the news and updates and exciting things that are happening around the world related to this topic. And it comes once a month. So you can look for us, and we're on Substack right now, and subscribe to the newsletter. Also, if you're doing something related to popular transport, if you're doing research, if you're doing efforts to integrate in your local government, if you're doing an innovative project, please let us know and we can get the word out there. Then the other thing that we do is we're going to start again. We were doing them last year, but we're going to start, we call them meet and greets, where essentially we're a network and we're a community of people that are interested in this topic and moving forward and learning from each other. So the meet and greets essentially are a platform where we can meet each other and learn from each other. So we'll have someone who's doing work in some place around the world, and they will tell us about what they're doing and how they're doing it and what are their challenges and what are the things that they're learning. And we can learn and ask them about different things. And so the meet and greets are really cool places. It's not like a strict webinar where you just hear, but it's more of a conversation. And then again, as a network, we also host events to connect with other people around the world who are doing work on this. And so we're trying to be in the key transport, urban, and climate events around the world and look to see if we are around. We will host some networking events and things like that. And we also host panels and workshops so that this topic has a place in the table and that we are part of a conversation. And we're pushing the agenda to not forget that popular transport is public transport and that it has to be part of a conversation. So you can find us in different places, and we would love to connect with people who are interested in starting to work more on this, or if they're already working on this. The network has people from all over the world, and the idea is to actually connect more and to learn from each other. Learning from each other and having a network usually accelerates change. And we have seen so many small changes happening in the last few years just because we connected with each other and we started pushing the conversation. And now popular transport is part of most of the transport agendas. Most of the transport organizations have working groups or have programs, research programs, have funding assigned to this. So the sector is growing, and I think there's a lot of opportunity to continue to mainstream this into the transport conversations and the urban conversations. So there's room for more people to come on board and join the network, and we will definitely be happy to have new members come in.
Super cool. So if you're not yet part of the network, I suggest you join now and sign up for the newsletter. It's very informative, saying this as a person who reads it every time it comes out. And if you want to find out more about popular transport, look for the Global Network for Popular Transportation. Like what Andrea said earlier, the first step to improving the sector is to understand it more. Thank you so much, Andrea, for popularizing popular transport. All the best with the campaign to better transport systems. Thank you.
And that's all for today's episode. I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to our moderator, Keisha, and our esteemed guest, Andrea Sengilion, for sharing such valuable insights on popular transport and its potential for the future. And of course, thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. We appreciate your support and enthusiasm for our podcast. Be sure to join us next time, where we will be discussing the fascinating topic of the mobility of care. We will explore how transport systems can better support caregivers and those they care for. Until then, keep exploring, stay curious, and take care.